Coffee and Chromosomes is brought to you by the charity Wouldn't Change a Thing, creating a world where negative perceptions of Down syndrome are a thing of the past. If you would like to hear more about a certain topic or even from a particular individual, then please get in touch with us. Email us at podcast@wouldn'tchangeathing.org and we'll do our best to try and make it happen. Hello and welcome to another episode of Coffee and Chromosomes. On today's show, we are really lucky to be joined by Leela Baxi from a very well-known organisation who have been working closely with those with additional needs since 1998. The organisation was initially established to provide speech and language therapy after recognising that the majority of people with learning disabilities do experience a degree of communication challenge. Over the last 20 years, they have grown so extensively that they are now made up of three organisations that work together to provide not only speech and language therapy, but a huge array of services. The list is pretty endless. They say that in life, anything is possible. And with this at the heart of their beliefs, you can truly feel how passionate they are working with children and adults with learning disabilities and their families to secure truly great lives in spite of the challenges that they face. Now, if you haven't guessed already, the organisation I'm talking about is Symbol. And today, we are specifically going to be talking about speech and language therapy services with a focus on early years up to around 7 years old. I'm really delighted to welcome Leela. Hi, Leela. How are you doing?
Good, thanks.
Leela, just to kick things off, it'd be great just to hear a little bit about yourself, just in terms of your background, your role at Symbol, and perhaps a sense of how and why you first became involved with them.
So I graduated as a speech and language therapist in 1991, and at the time I was a bit disillusioned with speech and language therapy because when I went to uni, I discovered that although we're very good at identifying what the problems were, we weren't very clear about how to treat them, and it seemed like there was a lot of pick and mix, lack of clarity. And while I was in my first job, Tessa, who founded Symbol, did some work for the Royal College of Speech and Language Therapists and published Communicating Quality, which was, they were called Clinical Guidelines by Consensus for speech and language therapists. And it was the first time as a profession, at least in the UK, that we had some agreement on what speech and language therapy should look like for different client groups. Well, I immediately wanted to work for Tessa, and fast forward 5 years, and I saw an advert for a job in an area where I was planning to move to, and Tessa was the contact. So I applied to Symbol and got a job there. I'd always worked in learning disability and special schools and in services for adults with learning disabilities. And my first job with Tessa was an adult learning disability job. But on a Friday afternoon, I joined Deirdre Clark, who is now retired, but a very important person in our services for people with Down syndrome. I joined her on a Friday afternoon in a GP surgery, providing groups for children with Down syndrome. Wow. And this had started because Tessa's son, Kieran, who has Down syndrome, was accessing those groups. And Tessa had established something local to where they live, because at that time, most people were travelling to Portsmouth to get syndrome-specific speech and language therapy. Mm-hmm. So I started off working with Deirdre, and it just took off from there, really. Our services grew and grew. Once other people heard what was going on in our little medical centre, they wanted some of it in their local area. We've worked really hard to ensure that the syndrome-specific speech and language therapy is available in other areas as well, not only from staff from Symbol, but also by training other people. The co-worker scheme harnesses the skills of other workers and families as well, parents who have lots of experience of Down syndrome and a special interest in developing speech and language skills. And we train up co-workers to deliver speech and language therapy, which really gets round the problem of there not being enough speech and language therapists to address the needs of everybody with Down syndrome.
I think in our journey, we have found that is it's a real problem. I think it is recognised across the piece. So having organisations like Symbol there is fantastic, because it is kind of a safety net for us all. And to have, you know, your support in helping train others, so there is some sort of consistency and a bit of a formalised approach, I guess, in how to help those with additional needs is a godsend, really. Now, speech and language therapy, I guess for clarity, what exactly is it? Because it is a lot more than just verbal communication, isn't it?
Absolutely. And speech and language therapists are trained in the medical side of communication and also the linguistic side, psychology, a bit of acoustics and sciences of sound as well. So we train in a wide range of areas, and it equips us to work in a wide range of areas as well. So there'll be speech and language therapists who work with people with voice problems. So that might be somebody who uses their voice at work and perhaps has some issues with voice production. Now, that might sound a long way from the work with children with Down syndrome, but we know that voice quality has a big impact on speech intelligibility for people with Down syndrome. And we know that enhancing voice quality, that we can improve breath support and improve phonation, and that can help with speech clarity. But we also know from the researchers that the amount of effort it takes for somebody with Down syndrome to produce voice is more than it is for other people of a similar age. So we know that the impact of the demands of voice production also impact on overall communication. So when we're working in the field of Down syndrome speech and language therapists, we have to pull in an awful lot of the areas that we know about. As you say, it's not as straightforward as, you know, helping with a bit of articulation or learning to put words in sentences. There's very little that speech and language therapists do that we don't draw on. So we also work with feeding issues, with eating and drinking problems. And that's not just in their own right, but also because all children develop the motor skills for speech production through their early feeding experiences. So we'll look at speech production alongside feeding for children with Down syndrome as well.
Okay, so that's really interesting, because I guess there that starting that intervention seems to be so varied, you know, depending on a lot of things. Some children here start that intervention from birth. We all know that we get told early intervention is really important. So how important, well, I guess how early should early intervention be? Is it birth? Is it 1 year? Is it, at which point should we be seeking these services?
So I think there's two ways of answering that question. One is from the point of view of families, and I'll come to that second. But the first one is about availability of services, because clearly families can't access a service unless it exists. Now, we're absolutely clear that speech and language therapy should be available from point of diagnosis. And of course, that may be prenatal. So because we know that communication issues are associated with Down syndrome, families need to access information from the minute they're aware that there may be issues for their child. Having said that, in, you know, this ideal world where you can get a referral to speech and language therapy from the minute you have a diagnosis, it's up to families to decide when they need that. So for many families, you know, during the first few days after diagnosis, they want as much information as possible. But other families don't take that attitude. You know, other families say, we just want to go home and love our baby and find out what life brings us in the future. And, you know, both those paths are absolutely fine. I've also met families when I've been running training who said things like, I've done nothing different with my child with Down syndrome than I did with my other kids. And he's now 5. And I've just listened to you talk about early intervention, and I'm thinking about all that time I missed. But we know that the way the challenges associated with Down syndrome play out vary between individuals. And for that 5-year-old who I met, he'd done really, really well with all the early childhood experiences that that family had for their other 3, I think it might have even been 4 kids. So I think it's about services being available from early on, and then families finding the right time to access that service. And that will depend partly on where you're at as a family and what your current concerns are. And, you know, clearly, if your child has medical issues, that's where your attention will be going first up, to make sure that they're medically stable and well before you're thinking about things like speech and language therapy, perhaps. But I think also, because our children vary so much in development, it does vary between individuals how essential it is to get that input in early on. And I think for us as experienced clinicians, you know, we can recognise which kids really need the extra help and which kids are actually flying with the experiences they're having at home anyway. So I think it's something for individual families to discuss with experienced therapists as to what's the best thing for them to do in their current situation.
And just to elaborate on that a little bit more, because it is the case that children with Down syndrome typically struggle more with speech. Do you have a sense on why this is? And typically, what are the sorts of things that parents and carers can expect when they actually come to you for speech therapy?
There's been a lot of research into the sort of challenges that children with Down syndrome experience. And there's also been a lot of research into the sort of therapy that's been offered in the past. Now, I have to say, you know, we'd love to look at the research and say it indicates that we should do this. But more what the research tells us is this is what people have been doing and it works. So there's research published in 1999, which is, you know, a long time ago now, which said very clearly that we should start work on speech motor activities during the first year of life. That's before a child is one. So one of the things we'd be looking at then, as I mentioned earlier, is early feeding to make sure that our children are getting the right sort of support to progress with their eating and drinking skills. Yeah. We can also do lots of work playing with sound, and some of that will be the sort of things that you generally do with kids playing with sounds where they say goo-goo-ga-ga and you say it back again. But we also know that working with sound cards, that's pictures that represent the individual speech sounds, you hold them up and you say them to the child and the child has a listen and maybe has a little go at saying them back. We know that that's quite effective in pushing our children's skills on. We do this work because it's indicated by the research and also by clinical experience. And, you know, there's several therapists who've published about what works and we've carried on with that. And also people like Deirdre, I followed in her footsteps. Deirdre was doing what was working and I copied Deirdre. Yeah. But on top of that, we have research that says things like the number of speech sounds that the child can produce when they're 2, 3 is predictive of how big their vocabulary will be when they're older. So when you say, why do you do what you do? You know, a lot of it is because it's what speech and language therapists have found works, but it's all underpinned by research.
That's really interesting. I didn't know any of that, about the speech sounds and predictability. So I guess in those early years as well, at the same time, something that I'm really wanted to ask you about was signing and Makaton. Now, that was a huge part of our journey in the early years. I mean, Kush was quite unwell for the first 16 months of his life and on a lot of heavy medication. But we were signing to him. And we still do, to be fair, because it supports him with, you know, his clarity might not always be there, etc. I know a lot of parents worry, as we did when Kush was younger, that by signing, you're building up an extensive bank of signs, but then there'll be no motivation then to vocalise if children are getting everything that they want by signing. What are your thoughts on that?
I think that's a very real concern. And if we only worked on signing and didn't support our children to overcome the challenges with speech production, that might well be how things play out. And I have to say, my experience as a speech and language therapist, I know a lot of, or I used to know a lot of adults who were receiving input around Makaton during the 1980s and early 90s, who communicated mainly through sign language because that's where they've been given support. So the approach we use is absolutely to use signing because it's such a good support for our little children, not only for them to express themselves, but also to support their understanding, to support their focus, to support their learning. So yes, we introduce signing early alongside work on speech production as well. And I think if you're doing both, there's absolutely no worry that our children will sign instead of speak because, you know, it's easier for them. Because actually we live in a speaking world and the motivation to speak is very, very strong. So where our children perhaps aren't speaking, it's because it's difficult for them. It's not because they've chosen an easy option. Signing is easy. It's speaking is hard.
So essentially, as best as we can, continue to use Makaton as a method of communication. Because I think one thing that perhaps we found as well is where that lacks, there's a sense that they might go on to kind of having negative behaviours. So essentially your kind of view on this is just to keep Makaton going
for hand as long in as hand.
Hand in hand with.
Yes, I'm a Makaton tutor, so I'm quite up to here on Makaton research. And I think one of the messages we need to get across about Makaton is it's a tool that you can use for many different jobs. So when our children are very little, we might use signing as the main form of communication. So we sign drink to them and then eventually they start signing drink back to us. But once your child is starting to speak and having a good approximation of saying drink, you might drop that sign. You might think, well, I don't need to sign that anymore. But your concern then will be that the child just goes drink, drink, drink and doesn't say, I would like a drink or would you be so kind as to get me the drink? So, you know, being a bit facetious there. But if we take the language structure, I want a drink, then the important signs are I want. Yes. So you might continue using your signing and particularly to support the beginnings of sentences, or you might use drink as a verb and say, oh, you drink orange and I drink tea and daddy drinks coffee and so on. So you can build up sentences, not just by using sentence starters, but also by using signs to combine words to make new language. Once you've got to grips with that, you know, our children are going into school, they're coming across new concepts. Learning the spoken word for those new concepts is tricky. It might take our children a bit longer. So we can use signing then as a bridge to learning the spoken word. So if the child is studying forces, you know, push and pull, they're quite easy words to say, but they're also quite similar. So if you have an action to put with them, if you have a sign to put with them, that will support vocabulary development. For a lot of the teenagers I work with, you know, a lot of them continue to dip into their signing to help when people don't understand what they're saying. Yes. So it might be that you then use signing just to clarify when your speech is difficult for other people to understand. So in my opinion, we really want to keep Mackerton in our toolkit and whip it out whenever it's going to be useful throughout the lifespan.
And then just for like any listeners that are starting their journey, how important would you say is frequency, regularity, repetition of Mackerton in kind of the day-to-day? You know, when we think about kind of when we started out, for it sounds like more, it's probably one of the first things that I think Kush learned. But we were kind of just constant with it in terms of the repetition. You know, would you say that's really important? Because some people get frustrated, and it'd be great to hear from your perspective.
So the ideal would be that everything you say is accompanied with sign. But of course, there's some practicalities associated with that. One is knowing the signs, and it's not important to know hundreds and hundreds of signs. As you said, you could just start off with 10. But the other is the practicalities of looking after a little one who requires lots of physical support and signing. And then there's also the issue of focused attention. So with my own kid, he was a very, very floppy baby, even, you know, beyond what you'd expect with children with Down syndrome. Every time I took him to the paediatrician, they'd say, oh, he's very floppy. Now, because he was very floppy, he needed lots of physical support, lots of hand-over-hand support. And, you know, I can tell you, even as a Mackerton tutor, even as a speech and language therapist, you cannot sign and support your child with physical movements at the same time. If you're holding your child up, you can't sign at the same time. My child's attention as well, you know, if he's looking at something, that has all his attention. And I spend a lot of time signing to his back or when he's not even looking. Now, we've got to be realistic about this. Yes, in an ideal world, everything you say would be accompanied by a sign. But in real life, you just get through as suits your child and your family and your situation.
That's actually really important for a lot of listeners to hear, because a lot of you might not know that actually Leela has a little one who also has Down syndrome. Now, Leela, I was always told frequently when Kush was growing up, I mean, he's still growing up, but as in when he was very small, just be mum. You can't be everything. You can't be this therapist, that therapist. Just be mum. Now, I mean, you are mum. You also have, you know, your career. You are a speech language therapist. How have you managed that? Tell us a little bit about your journey.
I've just got on with it, really. It hasn't been particularly difficult or trying. One thing I would comment, though, is when I'm being mum, I don't have all my technical knowledge in my head at the same time. And I find myself having little conversations in my own head where Leela mum asks a question and Leela speech and language therapist answers it. And I have to say a massive thank you to all the families I've worked over the years, because there are very few questions I've ever asked myself that I haven't been asked in the past as a speech and language therapist. So the information is already up there in my head. And yeah, I can tap into it when I need to.
Wow.
So one part that I think we often talk about is kind of going to the full extent, and I think we might be going quite far down the line in terms of conversation and the art of conversation in the sense of how we know it. Is that too much to aspire to, or is that something that actually is that within reach? And we recognise that obviously there's lots of factors in play here, and conversation in its most basic form is turn-taking. And so the kind of idea of turn-taking early on is obviously very, very important. But what's your thoughts here? Is that something that, you know, parents should aspire to, or is that something actually that might be kind of quite far out of reach?
I think if we think about that question from a disability point of view, human beings are almost hardwired to want to interact with other people. You know, during COVID times, a lot of people have commented that the isolation is so difficult because we're basically pack animals and we want to communicate with other people. Now, individuals with Down syndrome will face different levels of challenge. So for some people, that interaction will be through spoken language and will look very much like the sort of conversation you imagine having with your other kids.
Yeah.
For other people, we need to make adaptations to how we have conversation. So I think the important thing here is the notion of conversation. Yeah, absolutely, we should be aiming for that for everyone. But how individuals will have conversations will vary according to the challenges they face. Yeah. So for my own kid, he's a communication aid user. And when you have conversations with someone who uses a communication aid, the pace is very different than it is when you use spoken communication. So we accommodate that and do that. For some people, and with Down syndrome, it's very difficult to focus on what other people are saying while you're thinking about your own views and opinions. So you might have to adapt how you have a conversation in terms of pausing and in terms of turn taking and in terms of how long you get to hold the turn before you move on. So I guess it's about catering for individual needs and preferences. And yes, we should all be having conversations in the way that's right for the individual.
And I guess that can change, right? Someone's ability to have conversation in a way that works for them, depending on also environment and where you are. So I'm often astounded sometimes when school will tell me a certain thing and I'm like, yeah, but at home we can converse or we can whatever. But I guess you have to remember the environment is very different. So at school, it's very busy. There's lots of children around. It's not just necessarily myself and my child. We're having kind of focused time. There's not a lot of distractions because all of those things going on, I guess it's like any of us, right? Mm-hmm. If there's lots going on around you, you've got so much more to try and process. How much does that have an impact on our little ones?
Again, it will vary between individuals, but you know, as parents, you may have heard about sensory processing difficulties. And sensory processing is about how we deal with incoming sensory information. And we know that that's often affected in children with Down syndrome. So it may be that some of our children are more able to cut out distractions than others. And if your little one finds it really hard to focus, if there's a loud noise or even a quiet noise, or if something they can touch and fiddle with, then yes, that's going to have an impact. But for another child with Down syndrome, it might be that they're able to completely screen that out and focus. So I think it's about understanding individual sensory profiles. And again, yeah, about catering for individuals and taking individual challenges into account.
And that's where I guess it is really important to understand that individual. So then any provision or whatever that they receive can be formulated in direct response to that individual's profile.
Yeah, and I think also to have a little bit of knowledge about sensory processing, to know what we're talking about when we mention sensory processing, and to know where to access information. There's loads of websites and books that some families find really useful to pursue. And you know, as they're reading, they're saying, oh, I found out so much and it was really useful. For other families, that's not the most important area to be looking at. And it may be that the child's medical issues are what you're reading up about, or it may be that you're spending the time learning the signing. So it's really about pursuing what's right for the individual.
And on sensory processing, it's a term that we often hear. It's actually, we've read a lot about it. Which kind of pathology focuses on that?
But in the UK, the training, the sort of postgraduate level training, is open to speech and language therapists, occupational therapists and physiotherapists. Okay. But it is mainly occupational therapists who have the higher level training. Yeah. But there's different ways you can use that training. So sensory integration therapy takes you off for therapy sessions that do activities to build your sensory processing skills. And yes, they can be very useful for children with Down syndrome. But I think with the range of areas that we could be intervening in for our children with Down syndrome, it's not the obvious place to start for the overall population. And for lots of us, you know, for me as a mum, the way I use the sensory processing information is to understand the challenges for my child, insight into his behaviour, and planning what they call a sensory diet, which means anticipating his sensory needs and building around that. And there are lots of speech and language therapists who have that level of knowledge who perhaps can't do the sensory integration therapy, who perhaps don't have the training in the sensory integration intervention. Yeah. So I think it's asking around and finding who in your local network has the sensory processing information and can share that with you.
Okay, because that's an area I find it's not always brought to the forefront immediately, but it can be having quite a big impact on a little one.
I think in the UK, we've lagged a bit behind in recognising sensory processing issues for people with Down syndrome. So in Australia, New Zealand, Canada, United States, and lots of other English-speaking countries, South Africa as well, there's much more recognition of the impacts for our children and more management of the issues. And one of the things I emphasise in training for everybody, for the speech and language therapists, the co-workers, the families, is we all need to know about sensory processing if we're concerned with Down syndrome.
Fab. Well, there you go. So top tip there for everyone to go and read up on already.
And I suppose just on the topic of perhaps how advanced or how much more support certain other places provide our children, like what we get in the UK, I think most would agree, whilst sometimes difficult in the context of what's available elsewhere, perhaps outside of the countries that you mentioned, is actually really strong. But we do find in here often about lots of parents that seek the support, but they often get discharged early, even though there's known challenges, and kind of are told that either it won't get better or actually there isn't an issue. What would you say to those parents, and how would you say they could potentially respond to this? Is this okay, or are there any sorts of resources or anything that can kind of help?
Sue Buckley has commented for many decades that high expectations are really important. And I would say, first up, hang on to your high expectations. And if anybody is telling you, oh no, I don't think we can achieve them, or I don't know how we're going to get there, you go and ask someone else until you find somebody who can either say, well, yes, that is a fair expectation, but we're going to need to adapt how we realise it. So that might be me saying, I don't think that work on speech is really going to get you where you need to be, so we can do some work on the communication aid alongside it. You know, that sort of alternative approach.
Yeah.
So I would say hang on to your high expectations and seek around until you find the right people to help you realise whatever your child's dreams are. Mm-hmm. Now, when you talk about services are, you know, perhaps more advanced in the UK than elsewhere, we have to consider services as a bit of a mosaic pattern of who's providing them, because NHS services do, you know, in effect have to be rationed. There's such a lot of demands on the NHS and speech and language therapy departments. They all struggle with the number of referrals and the waiting lists and prioritisation. So a lot of the provision in speech and language therapy for children with Down syndrome is outside the NHS through parent support groups who arrange it, or perhaps people working with independent practitioners. And I'm sure that's true in all the other countries we've mentioned as well. So I think it's about accessing what works for your child and what's available locally.
That's absolutely the case. And also, I guess, whatever intervention that you might be getting from the NHS, there's still a lot that you could be doing at home to keep that consistency and that input. And as you say, you know, local support groups are brilliant, aren't they? I would personally urge people to speak to the parents in their local area as well, because that's where you often find those little nuggets, don't you, of okay, let's try this, or let's speak to this person. It is very much through the network. I wanted to go back to something you said a little bit earlier about the importance of pausing and waiting, and just talking a little bit about kind of the auditory working memory. Now, that's one thing that I was told recently, actually, and I just wanted to ask you to what extent you think this is true. So you and I, if someone asks us a question like, well, what colour is this? We can compartmentalise and think, oh, colour, okay, go to my colour bank, find a colour, and I can answer that question. To what extent can children or young adults with Down syndrome do this? Can they compartmentalise, or is it that actually they need to sift through their whole bank of vocabulary to draw on a correct word? And is that a reason as to why the pausing and the waiting is so important?
I guess it's a contributory factor, but when we think about the pausing and the waiting, I think it's helpful to think about the concept of processing time. Mm-hmm. And humans don't work exactly like computers, but I think the analogy is helpful. If you have a computer that's short on RAM, it will take a long time to do what you ask it to do. So you ask it to close a document, and it does close a document, but it takes some time. It's very clear from people with Down syndrome that time is something they want more of. Yeah. Lots more time. So in my head, you know, that song, Give Me Just a Little More Time, that plays all the time when I'm with my kiddie, because that is what he needs. Yeah. So part of it is about processing, but overlaid on top of that is the issue of language comprehension. So if it's more challenging for you to understand complex language, then you will need more time because it's more challenging. That's not just processing time, that's an extra element as well. But on top of that, we also have how you actually understand the question. So when you say, what colour is this? Keyword is colour. But you may also be asking, do you like this colour, or is this the correct colour? So the language around it needs interpreting as well. Right. If you say, what colour, you could say, what colour do you think this is? Or what colour should this be? Or what colour would you like this to be? Yes. So if your language understanding is not automatic, if you don't automatically get the full meaning, then it will take you a bit longer to work out, you know, what the answer will be. You'll need to use additional cues, or you'll maybe come back with an answer and then the question will be rephrased in such a way as you know what it is you're meant to be talking about. Now, we can see that for all of us, that will be really onerous. You might just give up on the whole conversation early on. So it's not just about giving extra processing time. It is also about the scaffolding. And if we do better scaffolding, if we support our children with understanding, if we make our own goals into ones that are attainable for them, then it will be much easier for them. And we'll get the answers. So I think that's something particularly to be aware of in school, where the questions are often framed by the curriculum, but perhaps may not be at a language level that's really accessible to our children. And then we don't find out what it is they know, what it is they think about the school topics, because it hasn't been framed in a way that works for them.
And I suppose thinking about the scaffolding and kind of creating the right foundations, reading, I mean, lots has been talked about it. It's so important. How much more important would you say it is for our children with DS?
You mentioned about auditory processing difficulties, and there has been research that says that the way children with Down syndrome process sound is less efficient than it is for typically developing children. So we know the auditory channel presents particular challenges. We also know there's a strong orientation towards visual. Now, when you think about us having a conversation here, that we can look at each other's facial expression, but we can't look at the words we're saying. So when you make those words visual through using signing, through using reading, through using symbols, you're accessing the stronger channel for our children with Down syndrome. So using visual channels is absolutely essential, and signing is one way of making language visual. Reading is another. Using symbols to represent ideas is another. So yes, it's absolutely essential. And again, people with Down syndrome will often ask you to show them. So drawing a picture, showing a map, having a chart is really effective.
I like that, making language visual.
Yeah.
I like that. So just talking, I guess, a bit more about symbol, how symbols support parents, you know, what services that you guys provide. Do you want to tell listeners a bit about that and where you guys can help?
Yes, in terms of directly provided services, there are a lot of people across the southeast who receive speech and language therapy in school or through parent support groups that's directly provided by Symbol. But once we started growing that service, it was really clear that there was far more demand than we could ever meet, not only in terms of number of staff we have, but also in terms of the location. So for people coming from further afield, we offer consultations. You can contact us to have a session looking at ways forward for your child. And that consultation may be feeding into assessment for an education, health and care plan, or it may be just to review the speech and language therapy goals and practice that's in place at the moment, or it may be around a particular issue that your child has aspirations to, work beyond the stage and you want to improve speech clarity. So really, wherever it is you're coming from, we can work around our consultations that way. But clearly, increasing awareness of what might work needs to be matched with more personnel, more availability of staff. So a big section of what we do is about helping others to grow services. So we have quite a comprehensive program of training in syndrome specific speech and language therapy that we're now offering online. It has all been face to face, but we've got online like everyone else.
With that training, I know you provide training for parents. Do you also provide training for schools? And is there any link between yourselves and the NHS? So in terms of like best practice?
The training we provide is really tailored around what people ask us for. Right. So when we provide training for parent support groups, they've usually had a number of other people train in various topics previously. So we just build around whatever's needed next. And yes, we can train school staff as well. We can train beyond speech and language therapy. We can talk about how to cater for the communication impairment associated with Down syndrome when you're looking at maths or topic work or inclusion. So yeah, we can train on a range of topics. In terms of links with the NHS, speech and language therapists work together across independent sector and NHS in clinical excellence networks, which is groups of speech and language therapists with a particular interest in a particular area. So we've had one running on and off since 2005 that was established with support of the Down Syndrome Association. But my observation is that as services have become more and more challenged in terms of resourcing, therapists have less time to engage in that sort of work. So we're not meeting quite as often as we were. Yeah. So another way we work together with NHS Speech and Language Therapy Services is by providing supervision or training. Okay. So Speech and Language Therapy Services approach us, and then we can run training for the therapists, or perhaps work directly with therapists with a specialism in Down syndrome within their services.
And that is obviously, that has to be seeked out from the NHS. They have to obviously approach you to say, look, we might have X amount of children in our borough. We know through, you know, education, health plan reviews, et cetera, that there is high need in our area. We need some help, kind of thing.
There's also examples of parent support groups buying in training from Symbol for their local speech and language therapy service. So they invite the speech and language therapy service to come to a session with one of our therapists talking about syndrome-specific speech and language therapy.
Oh, wow.
That's brilliant.
That's amazing, yeah.
Well, I just think, so I think kind of going back to the beginning, so anyone starting on their journey,
yeah,
what are the fundamental things that they should be thinking about? And I guess if you could just elaborate a little bit on kind of the physical aspects of it, so the muscular aspects of speech and the kind of things that can help with that. Because I think a lot of people go straight to trying to get to making sounds, not recognizing there needs to be particular muscles that need to be kind of worked before you even get to that point.
I think you don't, as a parent, need to fully understand the full research and scope of speech and language therapy. I think the starting point as a family really needs to be hold on tight to your dreams. Whatever it is you're hoping for your child, then we need to look around for people who can support us realise those dreams. And it will vary between individual family situations. So for my own kid, he faced such great motor challenges that actually taking him along to, it was a conductive education-based local charity, was the most important thing during those early years. I did also take him along to speech and language therapy because I can set up a local service and make sure it's happening. So I think rather than giving people a checklist of, you know, this is what you need to do, start with where you're at and where your child is at and build on there. But an important thing to bear in mind, as you know, as you've already mentioned, is the value of early intervention. That if we start early, we can avoid a lot of frustration, not only for our children, but also for ourselves, that we know we're on the right path and working in positive directions. And we also know that the earlier we can establish communication skills, the more success a child is going to experience in communicating. So there is a wide range of areas we could look at. You know, we look at vocabulary development, introduction of reading, signing, work on speech production, work on feeding. We could look at interaction. We could look at behaviour management. They're all things that speech and language therapists should know about and should be able to support you with. But what's important for your individual child will vary. Having said that, in our early intervention programmes, there is a pretty standard range of activities that we work on, which includes play. And that means play with dolls and acting things out, but also play with the mouth and practising some movements, playing with sounds as well. There's lots of visuals we use. We use the sound cards, we use the signing, we use the language through reading approach. So there is a pretty standard list of approaches that you could be thinking about. But rather than ticking off those on a checklist, I would think, well, what do we need as a family right now? What does my child need right now? And start from there.
Yeah, and on the early intervention, I mean, that as a concept, it's fairly recent, right? Like, you know, over the last 10 to 15 years, the concept of intervening early to try to help with development has kind of come to fruition. It's certainly not something that was prevalent perhaps sort of 30, 40 years ago, which is why perhaps the support wasn't as good as it was back then. How did we get to this piece? Where did the research really fall with regards to early intervention? Like, what have you seen through your experience?
The research about early intervention being important for children with additional challenge and disabilities actually goes back many decades. And there's a whole research community internationally who look at this for children with different challenges and different disabilities. And I think the Sarah Duffin Centre at Portsmouth were running early development groups in the 80s. So we have known about this for some time. There was maybe it wasn't until the 90s, but certainly they were running for many decades at Portsmouth. And the the aspiration was for people to be able to access this without having to make a long journey to the Sarah Duffin Centre at the University of Portsmouth. So we've known about it for a long time. I guess what's changed is the availability of services, and we have seen a massive increase in what we might call third sector provision. That's charities, parent support groups, providing early intervention to complement what the NHS is able to provide. I think the NHS speech and language therapy services, it's always been a particularly strong area, the support for little children. The issue for children with Down syndrome has been the age at which you can access services. So some services have had, in the past, had a blanket policy which says no speech and language therapy until you're two, or no speech and language therapy until you've established certain skills. But I think, as you say, that's fallen by the wayside now, and services are available earlier for many families.
And I guess the older a child gets, so even if you're in like infant schools, kind of 5, 6, 7, typically I think what we've seen is the more progress a child is making usually comes hand in hand with, well, they're getting better, as in they're progressing, so we can reduce some provision. Is that the right approach?
Not really, if we're hanging on to our high expectations. You know, however far we've got, we want to build on the next step and build on the next step. And I think the question is, can speech and language therapy help us get to the next step? And I've yet to find a situation where I say, actually, speech and language therapy can't help if it's a communication issue. There's always something we can do to help. But sometimes it is about coming at it from a different angle, and perhaps areas that have been worked on are no longer appropriate to work on, and we need to be taking a slightly different approach. So I'm thinking of an example of particular speech sounds where a number of speech sounds have been cracked and there's one that's not really getting cracked at all, and then we think about different ways of approaching that. So it might be that there's more motor activities we can do to help realise that speech sound, or it might be that given the motor challenges, you know, the speech sound isn't going to come, and we're having to make an overall judgment about intelligibility, and would this child benefit from a voice output communication aid, a computer aid that would give them a voice that's easier for others to understand.
Yeah, there's always something. It's just iterating, figuring out more, what's that next step. And I think that's the thing as well. I think us as well as parents, we kind of, it's difficult once your child is in school, or well, in mainstream school, I guess, to not compare with typical peers. But I guess it's trying to just keep in your brain, right, that that's okay. It's, what is my child's next step? What is that next stepping stone for us, that area of development that we are looking for?
Yeah.
And trying to suppress all the other, well, but, you know, they're all here. That doesn't matter.
Yeah, and I think the other part to it is, you know, with typically developing kids, if there is someone that's actually doing really well, lots of support goes to that kid to kind of help them continue that journey and get better. Whereas it's kind of really quite absurd, really, when you look at children with learning difficulties, just because they've achieved something, whatever that something is, it's almost a sense of, all right, well, they've done that, tick that box, now we can pull back. It's almost like we're limiting their expectations. So I think it goes back to kind of your earlier comment to what Sue so famously talked about, which is expect more and be ambitious about what we expect of our kids.
Yeah, so I think the comparisons are almost a bit of a double-edged sword, because it is really helpful to be aware of what other children are doing at this age, or how children grow up, and then think about that for our children with Down syndrome as well, but not in a way that brings us down and makes us look at all the things that aren't happening in an unhappy way. I think actually what's really important is to recognise our own children's talents and aspirations, and to nurture them just as we would do for typically developing children as well. So yeah, being aware of what other kids are doing is useful, but actually being aware of what your own kid is doing, is aspiring to, what their dreams are, what they're really motivated to learn about, I think that's really what needs to underpin our decisions. And having said, you know, we've got to decide what's right for individuals, I'm thinking of a teenage lad I work with who hadn't really had syndrome specific speech and language therapy and had a lot of challenges around communication, and he came along to one of the groups I was running at the time for about 6 weeks and took to it like a duck to water. It was amazing what he was achieving. But after 6 weeks, he stopped coming, because coming to speech therapy was interfering with his attendance at Special Olympics schedule. And the most important thing for him was his Special Olympics. And, you know, it was very sad to say goodbye to him, because we've made a relationship, but it wasn't sad to see Special Olympics prioritised above clear speech. You know, yeah, that was absolutely the right thing for him.
Yeah. I hope he went on to win a medal.
I'm sure he did.
I guess as well, just being a bit, well, for those listening in the future, hopefully this won't mean much. But right now, obviously, we're in lockdown. There's been a lot of worry, I think, within the community. The last 12 months have seen, obviously, unprecedented times, a lot of time out of education, a lot of time at home, and routines have been kiboshed and all the rest of it. Parents are worried right now, aren't they, about the impact on their children, on their development, I guess. Is there any reassurance, I guess, that you might be able to provide that, I guess, in the resilience of children? Sometimes our worry as parents is supersedes and gets out of control, whereas actually children are a lot more resilient than we think. Is there anything that you can provide reassurance-wise to parents after these last kind of 12 months where we might have seen less therapy or less services? It's not the end of the world, and we can pick up where we left off.
But I think first up is to recognise that there have also been opportunities in lockdown. So for my kid, it's actually been around toilet training, you know, that he's been in his shorts over the summer in a way that I wouldn't have been confident for him to be in school. But, you know, we cracked toilet training because we didn't have the same, it's probably my concerns, not him, but, you know, the same concerns about walking around in wet pants. So that solved a big problem for us. There's a lad I'm working with who uses a communication aid who's been supported at home with his mum with that communication aid through lockdown. And the support has been far more consistent than it was in a busy mainstream secondary school where he had lots of different people supporting him. And he has made amazing progress on his communication aid. So I think for lots of us, you know, there will have been advantages. Yeah. There will have been opportunities in lockdown that we need to hang on to. In terms of the services we've been missing out on, it's very easy to think about services in terms of we ought to be going to swimming lessons, we ought to be going to the dentist every 3 months, things that I absolutely haven't been doing. Yeah. Now, I have to think, you know, what's the long-term impact of my child not going to swimming lessons at the moment? Well, you know, he can learn to swim later. We haven't been to the dentist, but he hasn't had any dental problems. If he had done, I would have found a way of accessing dental treatment. So I suggest we move away from the idea that we should be accessing a certain package of services at the moment and think about what it is our children really need. And to summarise what our children really need, it's not just about direct work on skills. It's about direct work on skills paired with a really supportive communication environment. And I think for a lot of families, there have been fantastic opportunities to really get to grips with what our children need and also what's been working well in school and what hasn't been working so well in school, problems that we've been able to solve at home that we can now take the answers back into school and say, well, this is what we did in lockdown. This is what worked. Can we now implement that in school as well? In terms of the direct work on skills, you know, we like to work in groups because it gives children opportunities to learn alongside their peers, to interact with their peers, and also to not be the one facing most challenge. You know, when you have a whole group of kids, they're all challenged by the same sort of things, which is a different experience than working in one-to-one. So we need to think, okay, well, how can we boost our children's self-confidence and self-esteem, and what other opportunities are there to interact in groups and communicate in groups? And there's lots of stuff going online on Zoom that, you know, my kid at the beginning of lockdown didn't really know to look at the screen in a video call, let alone interact. But yeah, we've cracked all that now, and he loves his online football sessions and seeing kids at drumming sessions that we do together. Yeah. In terms of, you know, the direct work on skills, there's absolutely no reason why speech and language therapists can't continue to set goals with you and look at strategies with you and even work directly with children online. So I'm not sure it needs to be quite as grim as we think it is. I think another thing we've all learnt a lot about in lockdown with homeschooling is what's on the school curriculum. And when you mentioned that feeling of looking at what our child is not achieving, I mean, I have to say for my own kid, I think about the work in relation to him, and then I think about it in relation to his classmates. And the reality is that many of the children in his class won't be able to access or perform at quite the level that's being expected, that the work that's being sent home is being sent home by government specification rather than what meets our children's needs. So we don't need to be too worried about what our child can't do in terms of the work coming home.
Yeah. Do you know what, Lily? But thank you so much. You have got, and I remember this from when we met at the Congress, you've just got such a lovely way about you and aura, and you just give everyone this reassurance. Positive. You've got such a positive outlook, you know, your tone, the way you approach things and see things, it's really refreshing and reassuring. So yeah, so thank you. This has been really, really lovely, isn't it?
Yeah, no, it has. a lot of light in quite a dark time. So yeah. I really appreciate lots of your kind of thoughts and input and advice there. It's been really, really useful. I've certainly learned a lot myself.
So before we kind of wrap up, we've got some sentences that we're going to ask you. We'd appreciate if you could finish those sentences for us. So the first one being, I know that I have a great speech and language therapist when...
Fun.
Brilliant. So the other one is, for a new parent starting their journey with a child who has additional needs, please remember...
Love your child and to love yourself and to look after yourself and your family.
Brilliant.
Lovely. The single most important thing I can do to support my child's speech development is...
Keep up with their hearing checks and make sure that you're aware of their hearing status.
Fabulous.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for joining us. I know that this chat would have been so valuable to so many. What Symbol do for the community is truly phenomenal. So big thanks to you all. I feel like, you know, I could speak to you for hours and hours on this. So, you know, I recognise obviously we've focused more on early years here, but we hope that maybe at some time in the future that we might be able to build on this conversation further, you know, all from it. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
Beautiful girl with a beautiful smile in a beautiful heart.
Coffee and Chromosomes is brought to you by the charity Wouldn't Change a Thing, creating a world where negative perceptions of Down syndrome are a thing of the past. If you'd like to hear about a particular topic or from a certain individual, email us at podcast@wouldn'tchangeathing.org.